Actually, the computer does it automatically. I'll just print out the coordinates. After a moment, his printer whirred. Judy said, Is there any way of knowing how the earthquake was triggered? You mean, can I tell from the graph whether it was caused by human agency? Yes, I should be able to. How? He clicked his mouse and turned from the screen to face her. A normal earthquake is preceded by a gradual buildup of foreshocks, or lesser tremors, which we can see on the seismograph. By contrast, when the earthquake is triggered by an explosion, there's no buildup. The graph begins with a characteristic spike. He turned back to his computer. He was probably a good teacher, Judy thought. He explained things clearly, but he would be mercilessly intolerant of student foibles. He would give surprise tests and refuse to admit latecomers to his lectures. That's odd, he said. Judy looked over his shoulder at the screen. What's odd? The seismograph. I don't see a spike. No, there was no explosion. Judy did not know whether to feel relieved or disappointed. So the earthquake happened naturally? He shook his head. I'm not sure. There are foreshocks, yes, but I've never seen foreshocks like this. Judy was frustrated. He had promised to tell her whether the Hammer of Eden's claim was plausible. Now he was maddeningly uncertain. What's peculiar about the foreshocks? She asked. They're too regular. They look artificial. Artificial? He nodded. I don't know what caused these vibrations, but they don't look natural. I believe your terrorists did something. I just don't know what it is. Can you find out? I hope so. I'll call a few people. Plenty of seismologists will be studying these readings already. Between us, we ought to be able to figure out what they mean. He didn't sound too sure, but Judy guessed she would have to be content with that for now. She had got all she could out of Michael tonight. Now she needed to get to the scene of the crime. She picked up the sheet that had emerged from the printer. It showed a series of map references. Thanks for seeing me, she said. I appreciate it. I enjoyed it. He smiled at her, a big 100-watt smile showing two rows of white teeth. Have a good weekend with Dusty. Thanks. She got in her car and headed back to the city. She would go to the office and look up airline schedules on the Internet, see if there was a flight to somewhere near Owens Valley early tomorrow morning. She would also need to check which FBI field office had jurisdiction over Owens Valley and talk to them about what she was doing. Then she would call the local sheriff and get him on her side. She reached 450 Golden Gate Avenue, parked in the underground garage, and took the elevator up. As she walked past Brian Kincaid's office, she heard voices. He must be working late. This was as good a time as any to bring him up to speed. She entered the anteroom and tapped on the open door to the inner office. "Come in," he called. She stepped inside. Her heart sank when she saw that Kincaid was with Marvin Hayes. She and Marvin disliked each other intensely. He was sitting in front of the desk wearing a tan summer suit with a white button-down shirt and a black and gold power tie. He was a good-looking man with bristly dark hair cut short and a neat mustache. He looked the picture of competence, but in fact he was everything a law enforcement officer should not be: lazy, brutal, slapdash, and unscrupulous. For his part, he thought Judy was prissy. Unfortunately, Brian Kincaid liked him, and Brian was now the boss. The two men looked startled and guilty when Judy walked in, and she realized they must have been talking about her. To make them feel worse, she said, "Am I interrupting something?" "We were talking about the earthquake," Brian said. "Did you hear the news?" "Of course, I've been working on it. I just interviewed a seismologist who says the foreshocks are like nothing he's ever seen before, but he's sure they're artificial. He gave me the map coordinates for the exact location of the tremor. I want to go to Owens Valley in the morning to look for witnesses." A significant glance passed between the two men. Brian said, "Judy, no one can cause an earthquake." "We don't know that." Marvin said, "I've talked to two seismologists myself tonight, and they both told me it was impossible." "Scientists disagree," Brian said. "We think this group never went near Owens Valley. They found out about the earthquake and claimed credit for it." Judy frowned. This is my assignment, she said. How come Marvin is calling seismologists? This case is becoming very high profile, Brian said. Suddenly, Judy knew what was coming, and her heart filled with impotent fury. Even though we don't believe the Hammer of Eden can do what they claim, they can get a hell of a lot of publicity. I'm not confident you can deal with that. Judy struggled to control her rage. You can't reassign me without a reason. Oh, I have a reason. He picked up a fax from his desk. Yesterday you got into an altercation with the California Highway Patrolman. He stopped you for speeding. According to this, you were uncooperative and abusive, and you refused to show him your license. For Christ's sake, I showed him my badge. Brian ignored that. Judy realized he was not really interested in the details. The incident with the CHP was just a pretext. I'm setting up a special squad to deal with the Hammer of Eden, he went on. He swallowed nervously, then lifted his chin in an aggressive gesture and said, I've asked Marvin to take charge. He won't be needing your help. You're off the case. Chapter 9. Priest could hardly believe he had done it. I caused an earthquake. I really did. Me. As he drove the truck north on U.S. 395, heading for home, with Melanie beside him and Star and Oak Tree and the Cuda behind, he let his imagination run riot. He visualized a white-faced TV reporter giving the news that the Hammer of Eden had done what they promised. Riots in the streets as people panicked at the threat of another earthquake, and a distraught Governor Robeson outside the Capitol building announcing a freeze on the building of new power plants in California. Maybe that was too optimistic. People might not be ready to panic yet. The governor would not cave in immediately, but he would at least be forced to open negotiations with Priest. What would the police do? The public would expect them to catch the perpetrators. The governor had called in the FBI, but they had no idea who the Hammer of Eden were, no clues. Their job was next to impossible. One thing had gone wrong today, and Priest could not help worrying about it. When Star called John Truth, she had not spoken to an individual but had left a message on a machine. Priest would have stopped her, but by the time he realized what was happening, it was too late. An unknown voice on a tape was not much use to the cops, he figured. All the same, he wished they did not have even such a slender lead. He found it surprising that the world was carrying on as if nothing had happened. Cars and trucks passed up and down the freeway, people parked at Burger King, the highway patrol stopped a young man in a red Porsche, a maintenance crew trimmed roadside bushes. They should all have been in shock. He began to wonder if the earthquake had really happened. Had he imagined the whole thing in a dope dream? He had seen it with his own eyes, the gash in the earth that had opened up in Owens Valley. Yet the earthquake seemed more far-fetched and impossible now than when it was just an idea. He yearned for public confirmation, a TV news report, a picture on a magazine cover, people talking about it in a bar or the checkout line of a supermarket. In the late afternoon, while they were on the Nevada side of the border, Priest pulled into a filling station. The Cuda followed. Priest and Oak Tree filled the tanks, standing in the slanting evening sunlight, while Melanie and Star went to the ladies' room. "I hope we're on the news," Oak Tree said edgily. He was thinking the same as Priest. How could we not be? Priest replied. We caused an earthquake. The authorities could keep it quiet. Like a lot of old hippie types, Oak Tree believed that the government controlled the news. Priest thought that might be harder than Oak Tree imagined. Priest believed the public were their own censors. They refused to buy newspapers or watch TV shows that challenged their prejudices, so they got fed pap. However, Oak Tree's thought worried him. It might not be too difficult to cover up a small earthquake in a lonely place. He went inside to pay. The air conditioning made him shiver. The clerk had a radio playing behind the counter. It occurred to Priest that he might hear the news. He asked the time, and the counterman said it was 5 to 6. After he paid, Priest lingered, pretending to study a rack of magazines while he listened to Billy Joe Spears singing 57 Chevrolet. Melanie and Star came out of the restroom together. At last the news began. To give them a reason for hanging around, Priest slowly selected some candy bars and took them to the counter while he listened. The first item was the wedding of two actors who played neighbors in a TV sitcom. Who could give a shit? Priest listened impatiently, tapping his foot. Then came a report on the president's visit to India. Priest hoped he would learn a mantra. The clerk added up the cost of the candy bars, and Priest paid. Surely the earthquake would come next. But the third story was about a shooting in a school in Chicago. Priest walked slowly toward the door, followed by Melanie and Star. Another customer finished filling up his Jeep Wrangler and came in to pay. Finally, the newsreader said, "The environmental terrorist group, the Hammer of Eden, has claimed responsibility for a minor earthquake that took place today in Owens Valley in eastern California." Priest whispered, "Yes," and smacked his left palm with his right fist in a triumphant gesture. Star hissed, "We're not terrorists." The newsreader continued, "The tremor occurred on the day that the group had threatened to trigger one, but state seismologist Matthew Byrd denied that this or any other earthquake could be caused by human agency."
"Liar,"
Melanie said under her breath. "The claim was made in a phone call to this station's premier talk show, John Truth Live." Just as Priest reached the exit, he was shocked to hear Star's voice. He stopped dead. She was saying, "We do not recognize the jurisdiction of the United States government. Now that you know we can do what we say, you'd better think again about our demand. Announce a freeze on construction of new power plants in California. You have 7 days to make up your mind." Star exploded. "Jesus Christ, that's me!"
"Hush,"
Priest said. He looked over his shoulder. The customer with the Jeep Wrangler was talking while the clerk swiped his credit card through a machine. Neither man seemed to have noticed Star's outburst. "Governor Mike Robeson has not responded to this latest threat. In sports today..." They stepped outside. Star said, "My God, they broadcast my voice. What am I going to do?" "Stay calm," Priest told her. He did not feel calm himself, but he was maintaining. As they walked across the asphalt to the vehicles, he said in a low, reasonable voice, "Nobody outside our commune knows your voice. You haven't said more than a few words to an outsider for 25 years. And people who might remember you from the Haight-Ashbury days don't know where you're living now."
"I guess you're right," Star said doubtfully.
"The only exception I can think of is Bones. He might hear the tape and recognize your voice."
"He would never betray us. Bones is a rice-eater."
"I don't know. Junkies will do anything."
"What about the others, like Dale and Poem?"
"Yeah, they're a worry," Priest admitted. There were no radios in the cabins, but there was one in the communal pickup truck, which Dale sometimes drove. "If it happens, we'll just have to level with them." "Or fall back on the Mario solution." "No, I couldn't do that. Not to Dale or Poem." "Could I?" Oak Tree was waiting at the wheel of the Cuda. "Come on, you guys, what's a holdup?" he said. Star explained briefly what they had heard.
"Luckily, nobody outside the commune knows my voice. Oh, Christ, I just thought of something."
She turned to Priest.
"The probation officer in the sheriff's office."
Priest cursed. Of course. Star had spoken to him only yesterday. Fear gripped his heart. If he heard the radio broadcast and remembered Star's voice, the sheriff and half a dozen deputies might be at the commune right now, just waiting for Star to return. But maybe he had not heard the news. Priest had to check. But how? "I'm going to call the sheriff's office," he told them.
"But what'll you say?" Star said.
"I don't know. I'll think of something. Wait here." He went inside, got change from the clerk, and went to the payphone. He got the Silver City Sheriff's number from California Information and dialed. The name of the probation officer came back to him. "I need to speak to Mr. Wicks," he said. A friendly voice said,
"Billy ain't here."
"But I saw him yesterday."
"He caught a plane to Nassau last night. He's lying on a beach by now, sipping a beer and watching the bikinis go by, lucky dog. Back in a couple of weeks. Anyone else help you?"
Priest hung up. Jesus, what a lucky break. He went outside.
God's on our side, he told the others.
What? Star said urgently. What happened?
The guy went on vacation last night. He's in Nassau for 2 weeks. I don't think foreign radio stations are likely to broadcast Star's voice. We're safe.
Star slumped with relief. Thank God for that.
Priest opened the door of the truck. Let's get back on the road, he said.
It was approaching midnight when Priest steered the seismic vibrator along the rough winding track that led through the forest to the commune. He returned the truck to its hiding place. Although it was dark and they were all exhausted, Priest made sure they covered every square inch of the vehicle with vegetation so that it was invisible from all angles and from the air. Then they all got into the Cuda to drive the final mile.
Priest turned on the car radio for the midnight bulletin. This time the earthquake was top of the news.
Our show, John Truth Live, today played a central role in the continuing drama of the Hammer of Eden, the terrorist environmental group that says it can cause earthquakes, said an excited voice. After a moderate earthquake shook Owens Valley in the eastern part of California, a woman claiming to represent the group called John Truth and said they had triggered the tremor. The station then played Star's message in full.
Shit, Star muttered as she listened to her own voice.
Priest could not help feeling dismayed. Although he felt sure this would not help the police, still he hated to hear Star exposed in this way. It made her seem terribly vulnerable, and he yearned to destroy her enemies and make her safe. After playing the tape, the newsreader said, Special Agent Raja Khan tonight took away the recording for analysis by the FBI's experts in psycholinguistics. That hit Priest like a punch in the stomach.
What the fuck is psycholinguistics? He said.
Melanie answered, I never heard the word before, but I guess they study the language you use and draw conclusions about your psychology.
I didn't know they were that smart, Priest said worriedly.
Oaktree said, Don't sweat it, man. They can analyze Star's mind as much as they like. It ain't going to give them her address.
I guess not.
The newsreader was saying, No comment yet from Governor Mike Robeson, but the head of the FBI's field office in San Francisco has promised a press conference tomorrow morning. In other news,
Priest switched off.
Oaktree parked the Cuda next to Bones' carnival ride. Bones had covered the truck with a huge tarpaulin to protect the colorful paintwork. That suggested he was planning to stay a while. They walked down the hill and through the vineyard to the village. The cookhouse and the children's bunkhouse were in darkness. Candlelight flickered behind Apple's window. She was an insomniac and liked to read into the small hours. And soft guitar chords came from Song's place, but the other cabins were dark and silent. Only Spirit, Priest's dog, came to greet them, wagging a happy tail in the moonlight. They said goodnight quietly and trudged off to their individual homes, too tired to celebrate their triumph. It was a warm night. Priest lay on his bed naked, thinking. No comment from the governor, but an FBI press conference in the morning. That bothered him. At this point in the game, the governor should be panicking, saying, The FBI has failed. We can't afford another earthquake. I have to talk to these people. It made Priest uneasy to be so ignorant of what his enemy was thinking. He always got his way by reading people, figuring out what they really wanted from the way they looked and smiled and folded their arms and scratched their heads. He was trying to manipulate Governor Robeson, but it was hard without face-to-face contact. And what was the FBI up to? Was there any significance in this talk of psycholinguistic analysis? He had to find out more. He could not lie here and wait for the opposition to act. He wondered whether to call the governor's office and try to speak to him. Would he get through to the man himself? And if he did, would he learn anything? It might be worth a try. However, he disliked the position that put him in. He would be a supplicant, asking for the privilege of a conversation with the great man. His strategy was to impose his will on the governor, not beg for a favor. Then it occurred to him that he could go to the press conference. It would be dangerous. If he was found out, all would be lost. But the idea appealed to him. Posing as a reporter was the kind of thing he used to do in the old days. He had specialized in bold strokes, stealing that white Lincoln and giving it to Pigface Riley, knifing Detective Jack Kastner in the toilet of the Blue Light Bar, offering to buy the 4th Street liquor store from the Jenkinsons. He'd always managed to get away with stuff like that. Maybe he would pose as a photographer. He could borrow a fancy camera from Paul Beale. Melanie could be the reporter. She was pretty enough to make any FBI agent take his eye off the ball. What time was the press conference?
This book is continued on Disc 6. Disc 6.
What time was the press conference? He rolled off the bed, stepped into his sandals, and went outside. In the moonlight, he found his way to Melanie's cabin. She was sitting on the edge of her bed, naked, brushing her long red hair. As he walked in, she looked up and smiled. The candlelight outlined her body, throwing an aura behind her neat shoulders, her nipples, the bones of her hips, and the red hair in the fork of her thighs. It took his breath away. "Hello," she said. It took him a moment to remember why he had come. "I need to use your cell phone," he said. She pouted. That was not the reaction she wanted from a man who came upon her naked. He gave his bad boy grin. "But I may have to throw you to the ground and ravish you, then use your phone." She smiled. "It's okay, you can phone first." He picked up the phone, then hesitated. Melanie had been assertive all day, and he had put up with it because she was the seismologist. But that was over. He did not like her to give him permission for anything. That was not the relationship they were supposed to have. He lay on the bed, still holding the phone, and guided Melanie's head to his groin. She hesitated, then did what he wanted. For a minute or so he lay still, enjoying the sensation. Then he called information. Melanie stopped what she was doing, but he grasped a coil of her hair and held her head in place. She hesitated, as if contemplating a protest, but after a moment she resumed. "That's better." Priest got the number of the FBI in San Francisco and dialed it. A man's voice answered. "FBI?" Inspiration came to Priest, as always. "This is radio station KCAR in Carson City, Dave Horlock speaking," he said. "We want to send a reporter to your press conference tomorrow. Could you give me the address and time?" "It went out on the wire," the man said. "Lazy bastard." "I'm not in the office," Priest improvised, "and our reporter may have to leave early tomorrow. It's at 12 noon here in the Federal Building at 450 Golden Gate Avenue. Do we need an invitation, or can our guy just show up?" "There are no invitations. All he needs is his regular press accreditation." "Thanks for your help. What station did you say you were from?" Priest hung up. Accreditation. How am I going to get around that? Melanie stopped sucking and said, "I hope they didn't trace that call." Priest was surprised. "Why would they?" "I don't know. Maybe the FBI routinely trace all incoming calls." He frowned. "Can they do that?" "With computers, sure." "Well, I wasn't on the line long enough." "Priest, this isn't the 60s. It doesn't take time. The computer does it in nanoseconds. They just have to check the billing records to find out who owns the number that called at 3 minutes to 1 a.m. Priest had not heard the word nanosecond before, but he could guess what it meant. Now he was worried. "Shit," he said. "Can they figure out where you are?" "Only while the phone is on." Priest hastily switched it off. He was beginning to feel unnerved. He had been surprised too often today, by the recording of Starr's voice, by the concept of psycholinguistic analysis, and now by the notion of computer tracing of phone calls. Was there anything else he had failed to anticipate? He shook his head. He was thinking negatively. Caution and worry never got anything done. Imagination and nerve were his strengths. He would show up at the press conference tomorrow, talk his way in, and get a handle on what the enemy was up to. Melanie lay back on the bed, closed her eyes, and said, "It's been a long day in the saddle." Priest gazed at her body. He loved to look at her breasts. He liked the way they moved when she walked, with a side-to-side rhythm. He enjoyed seeing her pull a sweater off over her head,
the reaching gesture making her tits stick up like pointing guns. He loved to watch her put on a brassiere and adjust her breasts inside the cups to get comfortable. Now, as she lay on her back, they were slightly flattened, bulging out sideways, and the nipples were soft in repose. He needed to cleanse his mind of worry. The second best way of doing that was meditation. The best was in front of him. He knelt over her. When he kissed her breasts, she sighed contentedly and stroked his hair, but did not open her eyes. Priest saw a movement out of the corner of his eye. He glanced at the door and saw a star wearing a purple silk robe. He smiled. He knew what she had in mind. She had done this sort of thing before. She raised her eyebrows in an expression of inquiry. Priest nodded assent. She came in and closed the door silently. Priest sucked Melanie's pink nipple, drawing it into his mouth slowly with his lips, then teasing it with the tip of his tongue as he let it slide back out, again and again with a steady rhythm. She moaned in pleasure. Star untied her robe and let it fall to the floor, then she stood watching, gently touching her own breasts. Her body was so different from Melanie's, the skin light tan where Melanie's was white, the hips and shoulders wider, the hair dark and thick where Melanie's was red, gold, and fine. After a few moments she leaned over and kissed Priest's ear, then ran her hand down his back, along his spine, and between his legs, stroking and squeezing. He began to breathe faster. Slowly, slowly, savor the moment. Star knelt beside the bed and began to caress Melanie's breast while Priest sucked it. Melanie sensed that something was different. She stopped moaning. Her body stiffened, then she opened her eyes. When she saw Star, she let out a stifled scream. Star smiled and continued to touch her. "Your body is very beautiful," she said in a low voice. Priest stared, entranced, as she leaned over and took Melanie's other breast into her mouth. Melanie shoved them both away and sat upright. "No," she said. "Relax," Priest told her. "It's okay, really." He stroked her hair. Star caressed the inside of Melanie's thigh. "You'll like it," she said. "A woman can do some things much better than a man. You'll see." "No," Melanie said. She pressed her legs together tightly. Priest could see that this was not going to work. He felt let down. He loved to see Star go down on another woman, driving her wild with pleasure. But Melanie was too spooked. Star persisted. Her hand slid up Melanie's thigh, and her fingertips lightly brushed the tuft of red hair. "No!" Melanie slapped Star's hand away. It was a hard slap, and Star said, "Ow, what did you do that for?" Melanie pushed Star aside and jumped off the bed. "Because you're fat and old, and I don't want to have sex with you." Star gasped, and Priest winced. Melanie stamped to the door and opened it. "Please," she said, "leave me alone." To Priest's surprise, Star began to cry. Indignantly, he said, "Melanie!" Before Melanie could reply, Star walked out. Melanie slammed the door. Priest said to her, "Wow, baby, that was mean." She opened the door again. "You can go, too, if that's how you feel. Leave me alone." Priest was shocked. In 25 years, no one had ever told him to leave a house here at the commune. Now he was being ordered out by a beautiful naked girl who was flushed with anger or excitement or both. To add to his humiliation, he had a hard-on like a flagpole. "Am I losing my grip?" The thought disturbed him. He could always get people to do what he wanted, especially here at the commune. He was so taken aback that he almost obeyed her. He walked to the door without speaking. Then he realized he could not give in. He might never regain dominance if he let her defeat him now. And he needed Melanie under his control. She was crucial to the plan. He would not be able to trigger another earthquake without her help. He could not let her assert her independence in this way. She was too important. He turned in the doorway and looked at her, standing naked, hands on her hips. What did she want? She had been in control today in Owens Valley because of her expertise,
and that had given her the courage for this display of bad temper. But in her heart she did not want to be independent. She would not be here if she did. She preferred to be told what to do by someone with power. That was why she had married her professor. Having left him, she had taken up with another authority figure, the leader of a commune. She had revolted tonight because she did not want to share priest with another woman. She was probably scared Star would take him away from her. But the last thing she wanted was for priest to walk away. He closed the door. He crossed the little room in 3 paces and stood in front of her. She was still flushed with anger and breathing hard. "Lie down," he commanded. She looked troubled, but she lay on the bed. "Open your legs," he said. After a moment, she obeyed. He lay on her. As he entered her, she suddenly put her arms around him and held him hard. He moved fast inside her, deliberately rough. She lifted her legs around his waist. He felt her teeth on his shoulder, biting. It hurt, but he liked it. She opened her mouth, breathing hard. "Oh, fuck," she said in a low, guttural voice. "Priest, you son of a bitch, I love you." When Priest woke up, he went to Star's cabin. She was lying on her side, eyes open, staring at the wall. When he sat on the bed beside her, she began to cry. He kissed her tears. He was getting a hard-on. "Talk to me," he murmured. "Did you know that Flower puts Dusty to bed?" He had not been expecting that. What did it matter? "I didn't know," he said. "I don't like it." "Why not?" He tried not to sound irritated. "Yesterday we triggered an earthquake, and today you're crying about the children?" "It's a hell of a lot better than stealing movie posters in Silver City." "But you have a new family," she burst out. "What the heck does that mean? You and Melanie and Flower and Dusty, you're like a family, and there's no place in it for me. I don't fit." "Sure you do," he said. "You're the mother of my child, and you're the woman I love. How could you not fit?" "I felt so humiliated last night." He stroked her breasts through the cotton of her nightshirt. She covered his hand with her own and pressed his palm hard against her body. "The group is our family," he told her. "It's always been that way. We don't suffer with the hang-ups of the suburban mom and dad and 2 kids unit." He was repeating the teachings he had gotten from her years ago. "We're one big family. We love the whole group, and everyone takes care of everyone else. This way we don't have to lie to each other or to ourselves about sex. You can get it on with Oak Tree or Song, and I'll know you still care for me and our child." "But you know something, priest? No one ever rejected you or me before now." There were no rules about who could have sex with whom, but of course no one was obliged to make love if they did not want to. However, now that he thought about it, Priest could not remember an occasion on which a woman had refused him. Obviously, it had been the same for Star, until Melanie. A feeling of panic crept over him. He had felt it several times in the last few weeks. It was the fear that the commune was collapsing. He was losing his grip, and everything he loved was in peril. It was like losing his balance, as if the floor started to move unpredictably and firm ground suddenly became shifting and unreliable, just as it had in Owens Valley yesterday. He fought to suppress his anxiety. He had to stay cool. Only he could keep everyone's loyalty and hold it all together. He had to stay cool. He lay on the bed beside her and stroked her hair. "It'll be okay," he said. "We scared the shit out of Governor Robeson yesterday. He'll do what we want, you'll see." "Are you sure?" He took both her breasts in his hands. He felt turned on. "Trust me," he murmured. He pressed against her so that she could feel his erection. "Make love to me, priest," she said. He gave her his roguish grin. "How?" She smiled back through her tears. "Any damn way you like." She went to sleep afterward. Lying beside her, Priest worried over the problem of accreditation until he thought of the solution. Then he got up. He went to the kids' bunkhouse and woke Flower. "I want you to go with me to San Francisco," he said. "Get dressed." He made toast and orange juice for her in the deserted cookhouse. As she ate, he said, You remember we talked about you being a writer, and you told me you'd like to work for a magazine?
Yes, teen magazine, she said.
Right.
But you want me to write poetry so I can live here.
And I still do, but today you're going to find out what it's like to be a reporter. She looked happy.
Okay.
I'm taking you to an FBI press conference.
FBI?
This is the kind of thing you have to do if you're a reporter. She wrinkled her nose in distaste. She had picked up her mother's dislike of law enforcement people.
I never read about the FBI in teen.
Well, Leonardo DiCaprio isn't giving a press conference today, I checked. She grinned sheepishly.
Too bad.
But if you just ask the kinds of questions a reporter from teen would think of, you'll be fine. She nodded thoughtfully.
What's the press conference about?
A group who claim they caused an earthquake. Now, I don't want you to tell everyone about this. It has to be a secret, okay?
Okay.
He would tell the rice-eaters about it when he got back, he decided. It's all right to talk to Mom and Melanie about it, and Oak Tree and Song and Aneth and Paul Beale, but no one else. That's really important.
Gotcha.
He knew he was taking a crazy risk. If things went wrong, he could lose everything. He might even be arrested in front of his daughter. This could end up being the worst day of her life, but mad risks had always been his style. When he had proposed planting the grapevines, Starr had pointed out that they held their land on a 1-year lease. They could break their backs digging and planting and never see the fruits of their labor. She had argued that they should negotiate a 10-year lease before starting work. It sounded sensible, but Priest had known it would be fatal. If they postponed the start, they would never do it. He had persuaded them to take the risk. At the end of that year, the commune had become a community, and the government had renewed Starr's lease, that year and every year, until now. He thought about putting on the navy blue suit. However, it was so old-fashioned that it would be conspicuous in San Francisco, so he wore his usual blue jeans. Although it was warm, he put on a T-shirt and a checked flannel shirt with a long tail, which he wore untucked. From the tool shed, he took a heavy knife with a 4-inch blade and a neat leather sheath. He stuck it in the waistband of his jeans at the back where it was concealed by the tail of his shirt. He was high on adrenaline throughout the 4-hour drive to San Francisco. He had nightmare visions, the two of them being arrested, himself bundled off to a jail cell, Flowers sitting alone in an interrogation room at FBI headquarters, being questioned about her parents. But fear gave him a buzz. They reached the city at 11 a.m. They left the car in a parking lot on Golden Gate. At a drugstore, Priest bought Flower a spiral-bound notebook and 2 pencils. Then he took her to a coffee shop. While she was drinking her soda, he said, "I'll be right back," and stepped outside. He walked toward Union Square, scanning the faces of passers-by, searching for a man who looked like him. The streets were busy with shoppers, and he had hundreds of faces to pick from. He saw a man with a thin face and dark hair studying the menu outside a restaurant, and for a moment he thought he had found his victim. Feeling wire-taut with tension, he watched for a few seconds. Then the guy turned around, and Priest saw that his right eye was permanently closed by some kind of injury. Disappointed, Priest walked on. It was not easy. There were plenty of dark men in their 40s, but most of them were 20 or 30 pounds heavier than Priest. He saw another likely candidate, but the guy had a camera around his neck. A tourist was no good. Priest needed someone with local credentials. "This is one of the greatest shopping centers in the world, and it's Saturday morning. There has to be one man here who looks like me." He checked his watch. 11:30. He was running out of time. At last he struck lucky. A thin-faced guy of about 50, wearing large-framed glasses, walking briskly. He was dressed in navy slacks and a green polo shirt, but carried a worn tan attaché case, and looked miserable. Priest guessed he was going to the office to do some Saturday catching up. "Now I need his wallet." Priest followed him around a corner, psyching himself up, waiting for an opportunity. "I'm angry. I'm desperate. I'm a crazy man. Escaped from the asylum. I've got to have $20 for a fix. I hate everyone. I want to slash and kill. I'm mad, mad, mad." The man walked past the lot where the Cuda was parked and turned into a street of old office buildings. For a moment there was no one else in sight. Priest drew the knife, then ran up to him and said, "Hey!" The man stopped reflexively and turned.
Priest grabbed the guy by the shirt, shoved the knife in front of his face, and screamed, "Give me your fucking wallet or I'll slit your fucking throat!" The guy should have collapsed in terror, but he did not. Jesus, he's a tough guy. His face showed anger, not fear. Staring into his eyes, Priest read the thought, "It's only one guy, and he doesn't have a gun." Priest hesitated, suddenly fearful. Shit, I can't afford for this to go wrong. It was a split-second standoff. A casually dressed man with a briefcase heading for work on Saturday morning. Could he be a police detective? But it was too late now for second thoughts. Before the guy could move, Priest flicked the blade across his cheek, drawing a thin 2-inch line of red blood just below the right lens of his spectacles. The man's courage evaporated, and all thought of resistance left him. His eyes widened in fear, and his body seemed to sag. "Okay, okay," he said in a high-pitched, shaky voice. Not a cop, after all. Priest screamed, "Now, now, give me it now! It's in my case!" Priest grabbed the briefcase from the man's hand. At the last minute, he decided to take the guy's glasses, too. He snatched them off his face, turned around, and ran away. At the corner, he looked back. The guy was throwing up on the sidewalk. Priest turned right. He dropped his knife into a garbage bin and walked on. At the next corner, he stopped by a building site and opened the case. Inside was a file folder, a notebook, and some pens, a paper package that looked as if it contained a sandwich, and a leather billfold. Priest took the billfold and threw the case over the fence into a builder's skip. He returned to the coffee shop and sat down with Flower. His coffee was still warm. "I haven't lost the touch. 30 years since I last did that, but I can still scare the shit out of people. Way to go, Ricky." He opened the billfold. It contained money, credit cards, business cards, and some kind of identity card with a photo. Priest pulled out a business card and handed it to Flower. "My card, ma'am." She giggled. "You're Peter Shoebury of Watkins, Colfax & Brown." "I'm a lawyer?" "I guess." He looked at the photo on the identity card. It was about half an inch square and had been taken in an automatic photo booth. It was about 10 years old, he guessed. It did not look exactly like Priest, but neither did it look much like Peter Shoebury. Photos were like that. Still, Priest could improve the resemblance. Shoebury had straight dark hair, but it was short. Priest said, "Can I borrow your hairband?" "Sure." Flower took a rubber band out of her hair and shook her locks around her face. Priest did the reverse, pulling his hair back into a ponytail and tying it with the band. Then he put on the glasses. He showed Flower the photo. "How do you like my secret identity?" "Hmm." She looked at the back of the card. "This will admit you to the downtown office, but not the Oakland branch." "I guess I can live with that." She grinned. "Daddy, where did you get this?" He raised one eyebrow at her and said, "I borrowed it." "Did you pick someone's pocket?" "Sort of." He could see she thought that was roguish rather than wicked. He let her believe what she wanted. He looked at the clock on the wall. It was 11:45. "Are you ready to go?"
"Sure."
They walked along the street and entered the federal building, a forbidding gray granite monolith occupying the entire city block. In the lobby, they passed through a metal detector, and Priest was glad he had had the forethought to get rid of the knife. He asked the security guard which floor the FBI was on. They took the elevator up. Priest felt like he was high on cocaine. The danger made him super alert. "If this elevator breaks down, I could power it with my own psychic energy." He figured it was okay to be self-confident, maybe even a little arrogant, as he was playing the part of a lawyer. He led Flower into the FBI office and followed a sign to a conference room off the lobby. There was a table with microphones at the far end of the room. Near the door stood four men, all tall and fit-looking, wearing well-pressed business suits, white shirts, and sober ties. They had to be agents. "If they knew who I was, they'd shoot me down without even thinking about it." "Stay cool, Priest. They ain't mind readers. They don't know nothing about you." Priest was 6 feet, but they were all taller. He sensed immediately that the leader was the older man whose thick white hair was meticulously parted and combed. He was talking to a man with a black mustache. Two younger men were listening, wearing deferential expressions. A young woman carrying a clipboard approached Priest. Hi, can I help you? Well, I sure hope so, Priest said. The agents noticed him when he spoke. He read their reactions as they looked at him. When they took in his ponytail and blue jeans, they became guarded. Then they saw Flower and softened again. One of the younger men said, Everything okay here? Priest said, My name is Peter Shoebury. I'm an attorney with Watkins, Colfax, and Brown here in the city. My daughter Florence is editor of the school newspaper. She heard on the radio about your press conference, and she wanted to cover it for the paper. So I figured, hey, it's a public information thing. Let's go along. I hope it's okay with you. Everyone looked at the white-haired guy, confirming Priest's intuition that he was the boss. There was an awful moment of hesitation. Hell, boy, you ain't no lawyer. You're Ricky Granger, used to wholesale amphetamines through a bunch of liquor stores in Los Angeles back in the 60s. Are you mixed up in this earthquake shit? Frisk him, boys, and cuff his little girl, too. Let's take him in, find out what they know. The white-haired man held out his hand and said, I'm Associate Special Agent in Charge Brian Kincaid, head of the San Francisco Field Office of the FBI. Priest shook hands. Good to meet you, Brian. What firm did you say you're with, sir? Watkins, Colfax, and Brown. Kincaid frowned. I thought they were real estate brokers, not lawyers. Oh, shit. Priest nodded and tried for a reassuring smile. That's correct, and it's my job to keep them out of trouble. There was a word for a lawyer who was employed by a corporation. Priest searched his memory and found it. I'm in-house counsel. Would you have any kind of ID? Oh, sure. He opened the stolen wallet and took out the card with the photo of Peter Shoebury. He held his breath. Kincaid looked at it, then checked the resemblance to Priest. Priest could tell what he was thinking. Could be him, I guess. He handed it back. Priest breathed again. Kincaid turned to Flower. What school are you at, Florence? Priest's heart beat faster. Just make something up, kid. Flower hesitated. Priest was about to answer for her, then she said, Eisenhower Junior High. Priest felt a surge of pride. She had inherited his nerve. Just in case Kincaid should happen to know the schools in San Francisco, he added, That's in Oakland. Kincaid seemed satisfied. Well, we'd be delighted to have you join us, Florence, he said. We did it. Thank you, sir, she said. If there are any questions I can answer now before the press conference starts. Priest had been careful not to over-prepare Flower. If she appeared shy or fumbled her questions, it would seem only natural, he figured. Whereas if she were too poised and seemed well-rehearsed, she might arouse suspicion. But now he felt a surge of anxiety on her behalf, and he had to suppress the paternal urge to step in and tell her what to do. He bit his lip. She opened her notebook. Are you in charge of this investigation? Priest relaxed a little. She would be fine. This is only one of many inquiries that I have to keep an eye on, Kincaid answered. He pointed to the man with the black mustache. Special Agent Marvin Hayes has this assignment. Flower turned to Hayes. I think the school would like to know what kind of person you are, Mr. Hayes. Could I ask you some questions about yourself? Priest was shocked to observe a hint of coquettishness in the way she tilted her head and smiled at Hayes. She's too young to flirt with grown men, for God's sake. But Hayes bought it. He looked pleased and said, Sure, go ahead. Are you married? Yes, I have two children, a boy around your age and a girl a little younger. You have any hobbies? I collect boxing memorabilia. That's unusual. I guess it is. Priest was both pleased and dismayed by how naturally Flower fell into the role. She's good at this. Hell, I hope I haven't raised her all these years to become a cheap magazine writer. He studied Hayes while the agent answered Flower's innocent questions. This was his opponent. Hayes was carefully dressed in conventional style. His tan lightweight suit, white shirt, and dark silk tie had probably come from Brooks Brothers. He wore black Oxford shoes, highly shined and tightly laced. His hair and mustache were neatly trimmed. Yet Priest sensed that the ultra-conservative look was fake.
The tie was too striking, there was an overlarge ruby ring on the pinky of his left hand, and the mustache was a raffish touch. Also, Priest thought that the kind of American Brahmin Hayes was trying to imitate would not be so dressed up on a Saturday morning, even for a press conference. "What's your favorite restaurant?" Flower asked. "A lot of us go to Everton's, which is really more of a pub." The conference room was filling up with men and women with notebooks and cassette recorders, photographers encumbered with cameras and flash guns, radio reporters with large microphones, and a couple of TV crews with handheld video cameras. As they came in, the young woman with the clipboard asked them to sign a book. Priest and Flower seemed to have bypassed that. He was thankful. He could not write Peter Shoebury to save his life. Kincaid, the boss, touched Hayes's elbow. "We need to prepare for our press conference now, Florence. I hope you'll stay to hear what we have to announce."
"Yes, thank you," she said.
Priest said, "You've really been very kind, Mr. Hayes. Florence's teachers will be truly grateful." The agents moved to the table at the far end. My God, we fooled them. Priest and Flower sat at the back and waited. Priest's tension eased. He really had got away with it. "I knew I would." He had not gained much hard information yet, but that would come with the formal press announcement. What he did have was a sense of the people he was dealing with. He was reassured by what he had learned. Neither Kincaid nor Hayes struck him as brilliant. They seemed like ordinary plodding cops, the kind who got by with a mixture of dogged routine and occasional corruption. He had little to fear from them. Kincaid stood up and introduced himself. He sounded confident, but a touch over-assertive. Maybe he had not been the boss very long. He said, "I would like to begin by making one thing very clear. The FBI does not believe that yesterday's earthquake was triggered by a terrorist group." The flash guns popped, the tapes whirred, and the reporters scribbled notes. Priest tried not to let his anger show on his face. The bastards were refusing to take him seriously. Still. "This is also the opinion of the state seismologist, who I believe is available for interview in Sacramento this morning."
"What do I have to do to convince you? I threatened an earthquake, then I made it happen, and still you won't believe I did it. Must I kill people before you'll listen?"
Kincaid went on, "Nevertheless, a terrorist threat has been made, and the Bureau intends to catch the people who made it. Our investigation is headed by Special Agent Marvin Hayes. Over to you, Marvin." Hayes stood up. He was more nervous than Kincaid, Priest saw at once. He read mechanically from a prepared statement. "FBI agents have this morning questioned all 5 paid employees of the Green California campaign at their homes. The employees are voluntarily cooperating with us." Priest was pleased. He had laid a false trail, and the feds were following it. Hayes went on. "Agents also visited the headquarters of the campaign here in San Francisco and examined documents and computer records." They would be combing the organization's mailing list for clues, Priest guessed. There was more, but it was repetitive. The assembled journalists asked questions that added detail and color but did not change the basic story. Priest's tension grew again as he sat waiting impatiently for a chance to leave inconspicuously. He was pleased that the FBI investigation was so far off course. They had not yet come upon his second false trail. But he felt angry that they still refused to believe in his threat. At last Kincaid drew the session to a close, and the journalists began to get to their feet and pack up their gear. Priest and Flower made for the door, but they were stopped by the woman with the clipboard, who smiled brightly and said, "I don't think you two signed in, did you?" She handed Priest a book and a pen. "Just put your names and the organization you represent." Priest froze with fear. "I can't. I can't." "Don't panic. Relax. Leitor Pordoi Cor." "Sir, would you please sign?"
"Sure."
Priest took the book and the pen. Then he handed it to Flower. "I think Florence should sign for us. She's the journalist," he said, reminding her of her false name. It occurred to him that she might have forgotten the school she was supposed to attend. "Put your name and Eisenhower Junior High." Flower did not flinch. She wrote in the book and handed it back to the woman. "Now, for Christ's sake, can we go?"
"You too, sir, please," said the woman, and she gave Priest the book. He took it reluctantly. Now what? If he just scrawled a squiggle, she might ask him to print his name clearly. That had happened to him before. But maybe he could just refuse and walk out. She was only a secretary. As he hesitated, he heard the voice of Kincaid. I hope that was interesting for you, Florence. Kincaid is an agent. It's his job to be suspicious. Yes, sir, it was, Flower said politely. Priest began to sweat under his shirt. He drew a scrawl where he was supposed to write his name. Then he closed the book before handing it back to the woman. Kincaid said to Flower, Will you remember to send me a copy of your class newspaper when it's printed? Yes, of course. Let's go, let's go. The woman opened the book and said, Oh, sir, pardon me. Would you mind printing your name here? I'm afraid your signature isn't really clear. What am I going to do? You'll need an address, Kincaid said to Flower, and he took a business card from the breast pocket of his suit coat. There you go. Thank you. Priest remembered that Peter Shoebury carried business cards. That's the answer, thank God. He opened the wallet and gave one to the woman. My handwriting is terrible. Use this, he said. We have to run. He shook Kincaid's hand. You've been wonderful. I'll make sure Florence remembers to send you the clipping. They left the